Shalom and welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, as well as our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And it is with great pleasure and anticipation that we welcome to the microphone for today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Scott Shea, who is the chair and co-founder of Signature Bank in New York, but for our purposes today, is the author of a really fantastic, interesting, and much recommended work, a book called In Good Faith, subtitled Questioning Religion and Atheism. A nice, light, airy topic. Scott, welcome to Seekers of Meaning. Nice to welcome you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Rabbi Address. Thank you for having me.
This is, as we talked before we went on, this is not a beach book. This is a very, very well-researched, intense analysis, discussion, comparison, compare-contrast on the nature of contemporary religion and atheism. And it's a subject that comes up, I know, a lot within clergy, and a lot of times at very interesting and inopportune or sometimes opportune times. You start off, and really it's on my reading of the book, the thesis of the book, and you more or less point this out throughout the book, about this concept of idolatry. You call it in the book the default mode of humanity and the deification of self. That alone is a high holiday sermon. Talk to me about how you understand the concept of idolatry as the thesis of this book, In Good Faith.
Well, what I've learned, and one of the reasons that really motivated me to write the book, is that the Bible came to overturn idolatry. But we've lost track of what it is. You know, we have sort of assumed today idolatry is some sort of quaint bowing down to statues or magic making or Wiccan chants, when idolatry is actually was really bad and is really bad. Let me explain. Idolatry isn't about bowing down to statues as the Bible defines it, and as particularly the Torah, the five books of Moses define it. It's about lies about power. It's ascribing super authority or superpowers to finite beings, i.e. people, ideologies, natural processes, or in the old days, animals, but not so much anymore. So we may have thought that we licked the God King Pharaoh 3,800 years ago and celebrate the Passover Seder. And we don't have to worry about idolatry anymore. It's just about worrying about forms of, you know, other religions. But in reality, the whole 20th century was a catalog of God King Pharaoh, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, the Assad family, the Kim family, Hitler. I could go on and on and on until this very day. And, you know, people wonder, how did Stalin get away with starving a quarter of the Ukraine, killing all the kulaks, sending tens of millions to the gulag? How did Mao get away on his word to cause the death of 75 million of his Chinese comrades? It's because people viewed them as having super authority. They used the same tropes as the God King Pharaoh: myth, pageantry, poetry, parades, all of course backed up with a strong army and secret informers, etc. And so Stalin and Mao were unquestioned and unquestionable. If someone ordered, you know, Stalin famously had lists, if he ordered someone dead, if he ordered someone killed, murdered, they were murdered. And I think, unfortunately, that's a continuing leitmotif in society as a whole, and we've got to be on the lookout for that. And then I think what people don't get is that there's not only idolatry on a macro level, but on a micro level. You know, how did Charlie Rose and Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and Kevin Spacey and other names in the news, how did they get away abusing others? They got away with it because they were able to set themselves up as idols, where they were unquestioned and unquestionable within their companies and their industries. If Charlie Rose said something, that was truth at CBS. So they were, you know, and indeed Harvey Weinstein did have super authority over people's careers. If he wanted someone cast, they were cast. If he didn't want someone cast, they weren't cast in a movie. And so it's at both our macro societal level and in our most intimate encounters that idolatry is a serious threat. And the Bible recognizes that, and it shows how to combat that. And in the end, that's what makes it so revolutionary.
So this concept, and as you write, the deification of self, you expand that about a third of the way through the book, in this section called Idolatry, When a Lie Becomes the Truth.
Right.
This speaks to so much. You write, there's this fantastic sentence that I'd like your comment on, because it like could be ripped out of the headlines. You wrote, "A society becomes idolatrous when the consensus is to accept the rationalization given by both individuals and groups for exploiting, abusing, hating, and following evil leaders as the truth." This is the, if you say the lie often enough, often enough, often enough, it becomes the truth. That's idolatry, yep. Correct?
Yes, and I think, you know, right now in the synagogues all over the world, we're reading the book of Exodus. And I always thought it was very interesting. And this is how the Bible shows what idolatry is all about. When the Egyptian midwives, the Hebrew midwives, I think they're Egyptian for detailed reasons, but when these two Egyptian midwives say to Pharaoh, are ordered by Pharaoh to kill all the Israelite baby boys on birth, what do? They know it's wrong, but they can't tell Pharaoh something like, you know, it's really immoral to kill all baby boys at birth. That's a bad thing. They can't say that. Of course not. They would have been executed immediately. So what do? They lie. They deceive. But they deceive in the most interesting way. They don't tell Pharaoh what they're doing. They understand his lie, which is he thinks the Israelites are like animals. They're not like people. They're not like Egyptians. They're another species. So in Hebrew, when they say the Israelite women are giving birth, they use the word chiyut, which is, as you know, very close to chaya, or chayot, should I say, animals. It's actually the same letters as chayot, animals. The Israelite women give birth like animals. And Pharaoh amazingly accepts that because it plays into his own lie. He doesn't think, well, you know what? Israelite women, they probably give birth like everybody else, like all other human beings. He doesn't think that way. He not only says lies, but he believes his own lies. And that's actually the genius of the Egyptian midwives in preserving themselves. And it's constant. I mean, Hitler said that Jews were vermin. They were like insects to be crushed and not to worry about it. And so once you keep saying that, once you keep dehumanizing others, it's, you know, all sorts of horrors can happen.
It's the manipulation. And I think that's why the thesis of the book of idolatry is so, in many ways, so not only powerful, but so timely. You also write you spend a lot of time, obviously, unpacking aspects of Jewish texts, and not only Christian texts in the Quran, but a significant amount of time within the Torah and Jewish texts. And one of the things that struck me was your comment that the first commandment is to be viewed as a like a revolutionary document. Could you walk us through that? Why is the first commandment a document of revolutionary importance?
Oh, with pleasure. Because if we rewind back to pre the Bible, everywhere in the world, there was basically idolatry. The Egyptians, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, they all had their own god. And their god was, the avatar of their god was whoever was their god king. In Egypt's case, they called that god king Pharaoh. But you needed to do whatever your god king said. And god kings acted on their own whim. There was no sense of justice or humanity, and it was okay for the pharaohs of Egypt to try to kill all the Hittites. They didn't succeed, but they would have liked to, because the Hittites had a different god. They weren't even part of actually the same humanity as the Egyptians, which is so alien that we don't get that today. We don't get that having one God. The Bible starts by saying that every human being is created B'Tselem Elohim. That means that all humanity, regardless of race, creed, color, we all share that we have a spark of divinity within us, a spark of godliness within us. And that there's one God. It's not like, well, that person has an inferior God, I have a superior God, my creator, my group is superior. It's that there's all one God. And that was truly revolutionary. I mean, I actually just I show a chart of all the different idolatries across the world. They were all, some were more sophisticated, some were less sophisticated, but they were all idolatries. And idolatry, to a certain degree, this idea that I'm conquering on behalf of my God, is what led to empire, which also led to a lot of bad stuff. That's a good reading. Plus, I would just underline the definitive accounting for all wars in the history of the world shows that only 10% of all conflicts actually had religious, under any definition, religious motivations. I mean, people say that there were a lot of religious wars, but the reality is most of them were for the old-fashioned reasons of conquest, for taking resources. There really weren't that many. And that's even including the Crusades and certain wars, which clearly were religious wars. But on the other hand, and here's where monotheism can be weaponized into idolatry. It's when people don't follow the third commandment, which is taking God's name b'shav, taking God's name in vain. And, you know, the interesting thing is people don't, it's the only commandment, interestingly enough, the third commandment, which for which there is no redemption and no repentance. I mean, if you look at the Ten Commandments, you'll see that that it's a pretty strange thing. Why is that? It's because anytime someone takes God's name in vain, and essentially not trivialized, you know, by spelling out G-D or you know, not something minor that, but really, what does it mean to take God's name in vain? It's saying, I'm the sole spokesperson for God, and you have to do what I say. And you know, we've seen that happen. And then again, there are a lot of whores. Look at after the Ayatollah Khomeini became supreme leader of Iran, when he said that the Baha'i were heretics because it was a religion that came after Islam. And what happened? There was a mini Holocaust in Iran. And that was all because the Ayatollah Khomeini was saying, I'm the sole spokesperson for God. I'm the supreme leader. It's okay to kill the Baha'i. I mean, well, it's actually not. And I think that any religious leader who ignores, I argue this later in the book, because I think this is also the fundamental part of us all being created in God's image, a fundamental part of idolatry, is the golden rule, the way that Hillel formulates it. Don't do unto someone else what you wouldn't want done unto you. And if a religious leader says something that is at great variance with that, there's probably something wrong going on.
You write also in, which is something also that people will talk about between atheists and the religious, or as you call them, monotheists. Atheists take the Bible literally but not seriously. Monotheists, yep, in contrast, take the Bible seriously but not literally. That's a very important statement, especially in the light of so many pathways of how people interpret sacred texts. You're saying monotheists will take that, we hate this seriously, but we understand there's a contextual component of this. That seems to be a crux of a major confrontation, right, between atheists and what you call monotheists, how we look at that text.
So I have had a lot of encounters with atheists, and I really try to, you know, both in research for the book and subsequent to the book, I did a debate with Michael Shermer, who your listeners may know is a well-known atheist writer. He's written like 11 books. And I find that he and other people do something very similar, which is, he and other atheists, which is they take lines from the Bible, verses from the Bible, decontextualize them, and say, oh, the Bible is really, really evil, and we don't get our morality from the Bible. I mean, I have had a number, actually, that's what the whole second part of the book is. And I made it, but you mentioned it's a comprehensive book. I made the chapters, by the way, of section two and of a whole book to be easy to be used as a reference. So I talk about, one of the chapters is the Bible and genocide, the Bible and the death penalty, biblical inequality, monotheism and violence. You know, I basically take all the bad parts of the Bible that people, you know, sometimes don't want to talk about. I say, okay, let's look at this in its context. What is the Bible trying to convey? It's not always pretty, but it is usually understandable and even acceptable within modern morality if one takes the time to figure out what the Bible was saying. But to pull out a verse here and there, It's misleading, and it's not taking the Bible seriously. And I find, without any question, the most literalists, fundamentalists, readers of the Bible that I've ever met are the atheists. But they're not doing it because they take it seriously. They're doing it because they want to mock the Bible.
Right. I mean, many of our generation of being trained, and certainly in many of the liberal seminaries, are taught when we approach a biblical text, that you have to take the look at the context. You know, what was the social, political, economic, and religious realities of the time when that text was written? And once you understand that, you can then understand the text within its context, because anybody can pull, you can prove anything by extracting a text out of context from sacred literature. You can prove anything. The context is so important. Go ahead.
It's so important. I was going to say, we want to take the Bible totally out of its time frame. I mean, you know, President Obama ran two elections opposing same-sex marriage. Now, that wasn't that many years ago. And to, you know, to cite that as his view today would be, even, you know, within everybody's memory, I'm sure, listening to this podcast, that would be considered, well, you have to put some context to that. But people are unwilling to place any context on a text written, you know, 3,500 years ago, whatever, even people who think the Bible was written more recently, the latest the Bible was written was 2,500 years ago. So it was definitely a different time frame, and certainly a different time frame than 8 or 9 years ago.
You also, towards the end of the book, come around to the power inherent in sacred texts, especially the Bible, of relationships, which I found very appealing. I think you write, the Bible represents a book of relationships between individuals and between individuals and God. And the key may be really then how people look at that, and then how people act out their lives. I guess you're channeling the Hillel thing or Leviticus 19. Yep. So talk to me about that.
Well, the Bible starts talking about relationships and the danger and the possibilities of relationships right from the beginning. And I think we Jews don't look at the Bible in terms of original sin as being the point of the first three chapters. We look at it very differently. And I think we look at it as basically man and man working out the relationship between him or herself and between humans and God. And the Bible right away gets to, I think, what in certain regards is a core problem in of relationships and what causes the most problems, which is, and many people read over this. If you read the first chapter of the Bible, it talks about this wonderful, effortless creation. Everybody is created effortlessly, beautifully, with a spark of divinity. And then you get to this very, very strange ending, which is the end of chapter one. I think it's verses 28 and 29. So after this beautiful, you know, beautiful, beautiful creation story, then it says, God says, "Behold, I've given you all the vegetation, all the herb-yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree that yields fruit shall be yours." But to this is what he says to the humans. But to the beasts and to every bird in the sky and everything that moves, I give them all of the vegetation. And so it was. And then what happens shortly thereafter in the narrative? The serpent, the character, whatever that character, that serpent character is, tries to get the female, who's not yet named, so she's not yet Eve, to eat fruit. Well, why does he want the female to eat fruit? Because he can't eat fruit. Because it's resentment. The first, if you will, sin in the Bible, I don't want to call it original sin, is resentment. When we look at other people with resentment. I mean, here, human beings have, and then, of course, that's what happens with Adam and Eve. They said, why can't we have that one thing that we want? And here are people who could be living in an truly a place where there are no predators. You know, there's no predators for animals. There's no predators for humans. And yet people can't abide by that because of resentment. And if you read the Bible from there on, it's all the problems arise because of resentment, because we don't think about that Hillel's formulation of the golden rule. Don't do unto others as you wouldn't want done unto you. Remember the spark of divinity in every human being. And the whole Bible is about relationships. The Genesis can't end until that brotherly conflict that starts from Cain and Abel is resolved, until siblings can live with each other, until there's a place for everyone, until the covenantal family is united. It all comes down to the family now thinking, well, you know, I wouldn't want to be thrown in a pit. I shouldn't throw Joseph in a pit. I wouldn't want to be, you know, swapped as a bride. Well, you know, that's not a good thing to do anymore, etc. And it's all about relationships. And that's where we prove and that's where the rubber really meets the road.
Well, and you write also, speaking of relationships and biblical figures, introduced in a rather interesting chapter title called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Our Imaginary Friends.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really make any difference if these people existed or not, does it?
Well, the title of the chapter comes from, you know, how the atheists portray these folks as being impossible to be. But I do feel that, and I do argue in the chapter that characters such as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob could have existed. I mean, they're historically, from hints in the text, they're historically reconcilable with what we know about archaeology and history. But the point is, and really the point of the whole book of Genesis is, these are really important stories for us to learn from. I mean, we need to learn from the story of Esau and Jacob. And honestly, in some of the rabbinical, you know, glosses that we've had since the Middle Ages, I think that they take a lot away from the characters. I mean, the struggles of Jacob, he starts out as not really somebody you'd probably want to hang with. You know, lies to his father, who's blind, misleads his father, literally lies to his face. You know, I mean, taking advantage of one's father in that way is a pretty tough thing. And he has to make sure, and he has to live with that. I mean, he never gets to see his mother again. He ends up, no matter how you look at it, having a probably, I mean, we admire Jacob, but he has a life probably most people wouldn't want to emulate, you know, mourning for a child who may be dead, not being able to marry the woman he wants to marry, then having her die young, then having a whole issues with Simon and Benjamin. He lives a tough, tough life. And that story and how he ultimately becomes a covenantal member that we all feel descended from is an important, important story. And that's what I say when we need to take the Bible seriously, not just me, but extremely seriously, but not literally.
Well, I know that as we go around with Jewish Sacred Aging and teach Torah congregations or in workshops, one of the great hungers of the baby boom generation is to say, we are living in such a different world and we are experiencing so many different things in our generation. I don't need any fairy stories, bubble mices, or miracle stories, but I need to know how these texts that we're supposed to revere really relate. So when you do teach the patriarchal families from the book of Genesis, which are in every congregation, those families exist, they're in every congregation, and they struggle with family dynamics and siblings and stepchildren and all and life and death and mourning and reconciliation and estrangement. It becomes very, very real. And I think that's one of the key things that you unpack so many ways in the text, in the context of the book, that you really have to peel back the layers of this onion. If you're going to look at this seriously as an adult, then you really have to take it seriously, which is one of your arguments.
Absolutely. I mean, I just say one more point. Jacob only gets the point of his life when he's going to return to Egypt, you know, at the end when God speaks to him and says, don't be afraid. And then, you know, explains to him how he has gone through the covenantal process. You know, I mean, he only gets it. He's lived his whole life. And it's until he has that when he says, the first time that he really says Hineni, you know, is not like Abraham, you know, right in the beginning, but it's right in the end when God says, when he thinks he's going to Egypt for a few weeks to visit his son Joseph and come back. Well, and then he's got it.
Well, even Joseph's story, which is an archetype of many, many individuals, and when the final reunion takes place, I think in Vayigash, his first words are, is my father still alive?
Yeah.
And this is, it is, you couldn't stage this any more dramatically, but yet how many, you can align up almost every clergy person and they'll have an experience where a similar type of situation has impacted a member of their congregation or their own life, where, you know, ultimately it's about family and it's about those people we care about. Everything else becomes tangential, especially as we get older.
Well, and it's making the right choice. If I can just dive into that a little more. I know we've got limited time, but I think it's amazing when right before he asked, is my father alive? Joseph asked, is my father alive? The text says Joseph breaks down.
Yes, cries.
You know, but why does he cry? There could be two things going on. Maybe what he really wanted, as far as we know, he's could have interpreted Jacob having sent his father, Jacob having sent him away when he sent Joseph to sent him to Shechem to look into his brother's welfare. Maybe he thought that his father was part of this and that what he really wanted was to bring Benjamin down there, which is what he was trying to do. And then, okay, like the earlier patriarchs, one part of the patriarchal family would continue, the sons of Rachel. And we don't actually know until he asked, is his father alive, whether he doesn't want to break down because he wants to continue this charade and get Benjamin to be with him and send all the brothers, his other brothers, his half-brothers away and his father away, or whether or not it breaks down because he, you know, intended to at some later point say, okay, I'm Joseph. We actually don't ever really even know that. And I mean, that's part of what the power of these stories are is, you know, what are people thinking? And it's clearly Judah's speech that bursts him out of his bubble and forces him to come down and say, you know, I'm Joseph.
Right.
This is my father alive? We don't know that that's going to happen before Judah's speech.
So you write, which I found it was pretty cool, about the Martian.
Yeah.
The famous Martian. There's always a Martian who comes to Earth and has a look around. Because before we do run out of time, and will take too long, just talk to me about that little episode within the book, because the Martian appears a couple times.
Yep. So that's how I try to get people to contextualize the Bible, because I say if a Martian came down and looked at and came down just after, for example, Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces, and saw people literally dancing in the streets, and you know, and the president, you know, lauding this as a triumph. If that's the first thing that the Martians saw, they would think, whoa, the United States, a cruel people that likes to just pick off certain folks and kill them. They would have no context for that. And you may or may not agree with the killing of Osama bin Laden, but if you understand now not 9/11, you will get that. And throughout the, I also use the example of if a Martian were to look at the, you know, the United States or the even pre the United States sort of taking over the continent, that also requires context. Otherwise, and not even otherwise, maybe even with, there's some serious issues to grapple with. So I tried to show and to provide a parallel between context that people would give today to a Martian and what you need to be reading the Bible. And I think if you are willing to provide some context, you can get to an answer that's understandable, moral, not necessarily in every case satisfying, but you know, one that does answer the atheists.
So, Scott Shea, the book again, In Good Faith, Questioning Religion and Atheism, available at bookstores, on the Great God Amazon.
Yes. I like to say it's available at all quality bookstores and on Amazon as well. There's and by the way, there's an Audible version too.
Oh, okay.
Read not by me, but by someone with a much nicer voice, Andrew Totless. So a lot of people are reading that now. It's been a top 10 recently, so I'm really happy with that.
And I think you mentioned before we started, there's a paperback edition coming out.
Yes. In the, there'll be a paperback edition coming out in late spring. And also, if anybody wants to see the debate that I had with Michael Shermer or any of the other things that I've done, Google Book Talks on this and the like, they can go to my webpage, scottshay.com, S-H-A-Y.
And it's Scott with two T's, correct?
With two T's, yes.
All right. Scott, listen, thank you very, very much. This, we've just touched the surface. To my colleagues who may listen to this, There's a bunch of High Holiday sermons within the context of this book. It is, and it's something that perhaps would be the subject of a very interesting adult education class or series of classes in a congregation or a JCC. There's lots to unpack, and it can be an interfaith work because, as Scott points out in the book, he references a significant number of Christian texts, the Quran, as well as a significant number of Jewish texts, not only Bible, but codes and medieval texts. So it's not a beach read. It's a very serious, serious examination of an issue that comes up all the time. Again, the book is In Good Faith, Questioning Religion and Atheism, Scott Shea.
If I can mention one last thing, because you touched on it, and I should have. I have gotten people, different congregations who have been doing this as a 6-week study group or a 6-part study group.
Right, right.
Related
sure.
on the parts. So I actually have recently provided on the website a study guide.
Oh, good.
So the people who don't even read the whole book can use it, and it's also for rabbis and other clergy to use. So
that's very important.
Too.
And that's on the website again is
Scott, scottshay.com.
That's really cool. Thank you. That's really, I'm glad we touched on that because that's going to be helpful to not only colleague clergy, but educators who may want to, you know, a synagogue educator, a temple educator to develop something. So Scott, again, thank you. Continue. Good luck with the book and in your journeys, and stay healthy and just take care of yourself. Thank you.
Amen. And also to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank all of you again for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Again, we welcome your comments and suggestions to me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. We invite you to visit the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page and the homepage on jewishsacredaging.com if you'd like to continue to support the work that we do and these podcasts. please go to that page and click on the donate button to make a tax-exempt donation. Secrets of Meaning is recorded at the studios of Lubeckin Media Companies here in beautiful but windy today, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and we give thanks to our producer, Steve Lubeckin. Again, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Secrets of Meaning. Shalom.